The rest of us, we are in Genesis chapter 31 this morning. There's some excitement going down the hallway. All right. Very good. We've been studying the life of Jacob. He has served Laban now for 14 years under deceitful circumstances. He had an agreement with Laban that he would serve for one wife. Instead, he received an unwanted wife. And also was manipulated into another 7 years of service. Then for some, it might have been another up to 6 years he served at a time where Laban was manipulating the terms of their agreement. Up to 10 times he had manipulated the terms of their agreement in order to try to get things unfairly to his favor. Now, you can listen to last week's sermon if you want to better understand, if you weren't here, and you want to try to better understand all the options of what was going on when Jacob was stripping bark off of branches and sticking it into watering troughs. Even some of the language in the Hebrew is just a little bit, there's a few clues in there that he might have understood some things about genetics, though he wouldn't have used that terminology. Those might have been all about organizing the sheep and things like that. Or they could have just been shepherding superstitions that he was following. But in any case, what we concluded was that on top of whatever he was doing was God controlling the circumstances. Because even with total modern genetic understanding, within 6 years and the terms changing 10 times, you cannot manipulate genetics fast enough to stay ahead of Laban. And so it's just clearly God's hand working on behalf of Jacob, which is a beautiful thing to see an oppressed believer being protected by his God. And we're seeing the fruit of that this morning as we look at this. And this week we're just going to see it is just time for Jacob to leave. It's time from a relational standpoint. These men are at odds. They are enemies. And the countenance of Laban towards Jacob makes that clear. It's also time from a covenant standpoint. Jacob had made a vow, and it was time. God wanted him to make good on his vow, to return to the Holy Land, to tithe, and to worship him. And so we're going to see that as we look this morning. Let's read the entire chapter together, Genesis 31. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, "Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's, he has acquired all his wealth." And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable toward him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, "Return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you." So Jacob sent and called Rachel and Leah to the field, to his flock, and said to them, "I see your father's countenance, that it is not favorable toward me as before. But the God of my father has been with me. And you know that with all my might I have served your father, yet your father has deceived me and changed my wages 10 times. But God did not allow him to hurt me. If he said thus, 'The speckled shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore speckled. And if he said thus, 'The streaked shall be your wages,' then all the flocks bore streaked. So God has taken away the livestock of your father and given them to me. And it happened at the time the flocks conceived that I lifted up my eyes and saw in a dream, and behold, the rams which leaped on the flocks were streaked, speckled, and gray spotted. Then the angel of God spoke to me in a dream, saying, 'Jacob,' and I said, 'Here I am.' And he said, 'Lift up your eyes now and see. All the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family.' Then Rachel and Leah answered and said to him, 'Is there any portion or inheritance for us in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? For he has sold us and also completely consumed our money. For all these riches which God has taken from our father are really ours and our children's. Now then, whatever God has said to you, do it.' Then Jacob rose and set his sons and his wives on camels, and he carried away all his livestock and all his possessions which he had gained, his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear his sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols that were her father's. And Jacob stole away, unknown to Laban the Syrian, in that he did not tell him that he intended to flee. So he fled with all that he had. He arose and crossed the river and headed toward the mountains of Gilead. And Laban was told on the third day that Jacob had fled. When he took his brethren with him and pursued him for 7 days' journey, he overtook him in the mountains of Gilead. But God had come to Laban the Syrian in a dream by night and said to him, "Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad." So Laban overtook Jacob. Now Jacob had pitched his tent in the mountains, and Laban with his brethren pitched in the mountains of Gilead. And Laban said to Jacob, "What have you done that you have stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives taken with the sword? Why did you flee away secretly and steal away from me and not tell me? For I might have sent you away with joy and songs, with timbrel and harp. You did not allow me to kiss my sons or my daughters. Now you have done foolishly in so doing. It is in my power to do you harm. But the God of your father spoke to me last night, saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.' And now you have surely gone because you greatly longed for your father's house. But why did you steal my gods?" Then Jacob answered and said to Laban, "Because I was afraid. For I said, 'Perhaps you would take your daughters from me by force.' With whomever you find your gods, do not let him live. In the presence of our brethren, identify what I have of yours and take it with you." For Jacob did not know that Rachel had stolen them. And Laban went into Jacob's tent, into Leah's tent, and into the two maids' tents, but he did not find them. Then he went out of Leah's tent and entered Rachel's tent. Now Rachel had taken the household idols, put them in a camel's saddle, and sat on them. And Laban searched all about the tent, but did not find them. And she said to her father, "Let it not displease my lord that I cannot rise before you, for the manner of women is with me." And he searched, but did not find the household idols. Then Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban. And Jacob answered and said to Laban, "What is my trespass? What is my sin that you have so hotly pursued me? Although you have searched all my things, what part of your household things have you found? Set it before my eyes, before my brethren, and before your brethren, that they may judge between us both. These 20 years I have been with you, your ewes and your female goats have not miscarried their young, and I have not eaten the rams of your flock. That which was torn by beasts I did not bring to you, I bore the loss of it. You required it of my hand, whether stolen by day or stolen by night. There I was in the day, the drought consumed me, and the frost by night, and my sleep departed from my eyes. Thus I have been with your house 20 years. I have served you 14 years for your two daughters and 6 years for your flock, and you have changed my wages 10 times. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, and the fear of Isaac had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands and rebuked you last night." Laban answered and said to Jacob, "These daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children, and this flock is my flock. All that you see is mine. But what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Now therefore come, and let us make a covenant, you and I, and let it be a witness between you and me." So Jacob took a stone and set it up as a pillar. Then Jacob said to his brethren, "Gather stones," and they took stones and made a heap, and they ate there on the heap. Laban called it Jeger Shehudatha, but Jacob called it Galeed. And Jacob said, "This heap," both meaning the same thing in different languages, "and Jacob said, 'This heap is a witness between you and me this day.' Therefore its name was called Galeed, also Mizpah, because he said, 'May the Lord watch between you and me when we are absent one from another. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me.'" Then Laban said to Jacob, "Here is the heap, and here is the pillar which I have placed between you and me. This heap is a witness, and this pillar is a witness, that I will not pass beyond this heap to you, and you will not pass beyond this heap and this pillar to me for harm. The God of Abraham, the God of Nahor, and the God of their father judge between us. And Jacob swore by the fear of his father Isaac, and then Jacob offered a sacrifice on the mountain and called his brethren to eat bread. And they ate bread and stayed all night on the mountain. And early in the morning Laban arose, kissed his sons and daughters, and blessed them. Then Laban departed and returned to his place. Let's pray. Father, as we look at this extensive narrative this morning, and we see a parting, and Father, it is peaceful, but it does not seem entirely amicable and friendly. God, I pray that you would just open up the text to us, where we are going in these narratives. Help us to see your hand at work continually in the lives of the patriarchs. Father, I pray that we could learn some things that would even change our lives in terms of application and how we relate to others. I pray, God, that you would use this text as you see fit. It is in Jesus' name that I pray. Amen. As we begin this morning, we have outlines in your bulletin if you'd like to follow along. God's presence is with Jacob. God's presence with Jacob is assured in the face of opposition from Laban's family. See, that's how it opens in verses 1 through 3 for this chapter. Now Jacob heard the words of Laban's son, saying, Jacob has taken away all that was our father's, and from what was our father's he has acquired all his wealth. And Jacob saw the countenance of Laban, and indeed it was not favorable to him as before. Then the Lord said to Jacob, return to the land of your fathers and to your family, and I will be with you. Okay, now Laban's son are complaining. Why? Well, their inheritance is now reduced. What Jacob acquired from the flocks of Laban is really from their future purse. He has become mightily wealthy to have camels. He listed his wealth in the previous verse, chapter 30, verse number 42. He had large flocks, female and male servants, camels and donkeys. To have camels was somewhat rare. I mean, this was a man of notable wealth by this time. And God is allowing this family enmity to happen because of the funds, because of the money. And it seems that God is using family enmity to prepare Jacob's heart for a move back to the Holy Land. Now, some of you might have family problems and family stresses. I dare say that they are nothing like what Jacob is facing here in terms of his extended family. When it says there in verse number 2 that Laban's countenance was not favorable to him, that there just seems like there's a dire threat in that. That maybe even perhaps his life is in danger at this point. Now, it's one thing to have this guy Jacob there, and God's blessing Jacob, and you're acquiring all the sheep. We saw that in chapter 30. Laban said, God has blessed me because of you. I learned it through divination, whatever that is. We talked about that last week. But, I learned it through divination. God is blessing me because of you. So it's one thing to have Jacob around and receive, but now God's blessing Jacob, and you're on the outside. In fact, perhaps God is judging you because you have laid a hand on the promised seed. That whole Abrahamic promise, those who curse you, I will curse. Okay? And so now Laban's on the receiving end, and it's just a whole different story. It's a whole different relationship. His countenance towards Jacob has changed. Now, I think there's big problems here. I mean, there's been problems for 20 years. This man Laban has been conniving and manipulating and switching daughters and then requiring another 7 years for the daughter he promised in the first place, knowing Jacob wouldn't just leave the love of his life. And then the 6 years of agreement for the flocks and changing the wages 10 times, Jacob says it to the wives, which you could say, is that true or not? But when Jacob says it to Laban, he shuts his mouth because he knows he's changed the wages 10 times. Okay, and so this is just a life full of problems. Do you think God wanted these problems for a purpose in Jacob's life? Let me take you back to when Jacob was a young man. You remember the whole selling of pottage, the selling of the stew, the red stew to Esau for the birthright? I think, we've seen quite clearly, Jacob is a young man given to deceit and greed. And now here he sits in Paddan Aram, the area of Haran, and life is good. Okay, I mean, he is getting wealthy. He has notable wealth here. Why leave? Because what's waiting for him back in the promised land? Esau. What was Esau's countenance toward him when he left? Well, it wasn't good. It was murderous. I will kill him as soon as my father is dead. Okay, so why go back to the promised land when life is so good and panning all around? Let's just stick around. I think God has a higher plan here. Laban's evils are evil. His son's evil are evil. Evils are evil. But God has a plan. God has a purpose. So as we go through the narrative today, I mean, just think. Are there any interpersonal problems that you might have with family? Or with neighbors? Or with co-workers? Or any sector of your life? As believers, we are commanded to repent, to seek forgiveness, to forgive, and to love. But when none of that works, when God is just allowing ongoing enmity and strife to continue unchecked, and it just hurts, consider He has a higher agenda in all of this. Okay, so Jacob goes to his wives here, letter A. He explains to his wives the estrangement he has experienced with Laban and Laban's sons. That begins in verse number 4. He called Rachel and Leah to the field, said, "I've seen your father's countenance. It's not favor." He recounts all of the evil toward them. And notice this in verse number 8. If he said, "The speckled shall be your wages," then the flocks bore speckled. If he said, "Thus, the streaked shall bore your wages," then all the flocks bore streaked. Wait a minute. In chapter 30, weren't all the speckled and all the spotted supposed to go to Jacob? As I recall reading the narrative, yeah, that was the case. In fact, as we looked at that narrative, it began with dialogue for the first half, and then it was all narrative for the second half. And right where it switches from dialogue to narrative, there's this disjuncture, because it seems like Jacob is saying, okay, here's my wages. I will pass through your flocks today. I will remove all the speckled and spotted, and they shall be my wages. And then the next verse, the narrator says, and so Laban goes through that day, removes all the speckled and spotted, gives them to his sons, puts them 3 days' journey away. And it's like, you just see Jacob going through these fields. It's like, as you read it, you're like, hold it, that doesn't seem to be what they agreed upon. Duh, that's exactly right. That's the way Laban worked. Go ahead, pass through the flocks. You won't find any speckled or spotted. I don't own any. I gave them to my 3 sons before you got there. And so, you know, the agreement was speckled and spotted, but here Jacob is saying he changed the wages 10 times. And if he said just the speckled, they just bore speckled. If he said just the striped, they bore just striped. That's life with Laban. And so he recounts this to his wives. And you got to ask yourself this. Now, wait a minute. He's asking his wives to leave their ancestral homeland, to leave their father. This has not been a peaceful family. Okay? Jacob, you know, with Leah and Rachel, it's not something that we would mistake, you know, as family of the year. Okay, you know, as they have children, they give them names like wrestling, because I have wrestled and prevailed over my sister. Okay, I mean, this is the kind of enmity. There's this bartering for who gets to sleep with Jacob. Oh, you give me your mandrakes, and then yeah, let him sleep with you tonight. Okay, and so this has not been a peaceful family at all. And Leah, in particular, has been unloved. The scriptures have recorded she is unloved. She is the unloved one. She conspired with her father to wear the veil and to pass herself off as Rachel, to be married to this Jacob, and to totally ruin what would have been a happy, monogamous, lifelong relationship. And, duh, she's unloved. I mean, we're not surprised at that, you know, from a human standpoint. Okay? If Leah conspired with her father to worm her way into Jacob's life, and if she has been unloved by Jacob, what's the chances that there's going to be unity in this decision to leave? There might be a problem in that, but we'll keep going here. Now, as Jacob recounts letter B, God's call, we see God reminding him of his promise. Jacob recounts this vision that he had, and he recounts the words of the Lord. And he says here, if we go right to the words of the Lord, verse number 12, he said, "Lift up your eyes now and see, the rams which leap on the flocks are streaked, speckled, and gray spotted, for I have seen all that Laban is doing to you. I am the God of Bethel, where you anointed the pillar, and where you made a vow to me. Now arise, get out of this land, and return to the land of your family." Okay, so as Jacob recounts God's call to him, this special vision, God is reminding him of a promise. He's saying, hey, Jacob, remember, I'm the God of Bethel, house of God. That place Jacob called house of God. We had the ladder from heaven, angels ascending and descending. Looked like the very portal of heaven where God would dispense his angels to do their work. They'd come back and report to him. Jacob was like, this is the place. It's the house of God. And so he made this vow there, and God reminds him of it. Turn to chapter 20, verse number 28. Chapter 28, verse number 20. This is the vow that Jacob made. Then Jacob made a vow saying, if God will be with me and will keep me in this way that I am going and give me bread to eat and clothing to put on so that I come back to my father's house in peace, then the Lord is my God. And this stone which I have set as a pillar shall be God's house. And of all that you give me, I will surely give a tenth to you. And so this is the vow, and God is reminding him. I think this is a major part of the chapter here, chapter 31. God is preparing his heart to go back, and Jacob is obeying, and he is going back. Jacob will obey. God is using circumstances. It seems to be a bit of a partnership here going on to make sure that God's will happen and happens. And isn't that the way it works in our lives? Letter C here. On this issue, the wise are of one accord. And I'm shocked, by this fact. They're of one accord, citing their father's ill treatment toward them as their reason for wishing to depart. That you would have these two wives on the same page on anything is a shock to me. This is not a peaceful house. The brothers sold Joseph into slavery. That's where this household is going. That's the kind of enmity. When Joseph names his child Forget, when he has two children, Ephraim and Manasseh, one of them means forget, because God has enabled me to forget my father's household and all of my toils. This is not a happy household, so I'm just totally shocked that they would agree. And it seems that God has used some hard circumstances in their lives to get them on the same page. Verse number 14, they answered, is there any portion of inheritance in our father's house? Are we not considered strangers by him? Now how? How would he consider you strangers? The next sentence, for he has sold us and completely consumed our money. So he sold us like slaves, is what they're saying. Now, is that what happened? Understand the difference between a wife and a concubine. A wife is a wife that comes with full dowry in her marriage contract. She has full dowry. The dowry was a sum of wealth, and it remained her possession even in the marriage. And it was a safeguard. If that husband should die, if he should abandon her, she had her dowry to provide for her. She's a wife of full status in antiquities. A concubine is a wife. It's a marriage contract, but she has no dowry. Now, there's also... dowry is one thing, bride price is another. Lobola in South Africa. Okay? Bride price is another thing. That is reimbursing the father. Now, what would often happen is that the bride price would become the dowry. The father would be given the bride price, and that money would then go to the bride as her dowry. Well, Jacob had no money. His own testimony will be soon. I left with nothing but a staff in my hand, and now I'm coming back home with great wealth. He had no money, but he had labor. And he served 7 years for Leah, another 7 years for Rachel. And how did that work out financially for Laban? It succeeded famously. Laban said that, my flocks are tremendously large since you came. God is blessing me for your sake, Jacob. And so what should have happened is blessing should be the wife's blessing, because his labor was nothing more than a bride price. And Laban, ever being the conniver, keeps it all. And so, in effect, what he has done is he has sold them as concubines. He sold them for Jacob's labor and consumed it all. They have no dowry. They're really not full status wives. And that's going to weigh on Laban's mind. You're going to see that in a little bit in the text if you didn't already see it when we read. It's going to weigh on his mind. And he'll bring that up here in a few minutes. Okay, so now in our first point, we're seeing Jacob's obedience returning to Canaan. And what might be this surprising unity between his wives and leaving Laban's household. In the second point, we're going to see Jacob in need of God's help to accomplish this. It's not going to go well without God's help. And unfortunately, human sin isn't going to help him either here. Point number two, Jacob fled Laban's house, taking his wife, and unknowingly to Jacob, a stolen possession of Laban's. See that in verse number 17. Then Jacob arose and said, his sons and wives and camels, carried away all his livestock, all his possessions which he had gained, acquired, and his acquired livestock which he had gained in Paddan Aram, to go to his father Isaac in the land of Canaan. Now Laban had gone to shear sheep, and Rachel had stolen the household idols which were her father's. And Jacob stole away unknowingly. Now, okay, what's going on here? Just when we think we're all Christians, idols pop up into the pictures. God's, Laban has false gods. What's he doing with false gods? When he met Abraham's servant, he used all of the talk about Yahweh, and he submitted to Yahweh's will. And Rachel, she, in the birth of her children, had expressed that God had helped her and God had removed her reproach. I thought we're all believers in the covenant. What are we doing with these gods? What are Rachel's interests in these gods? Maybe we're not all believers. Then again, maybe we are all believers in this narrative. And that these gods, while sinful to possess, are not what we would normally think of as false gods like Baals or Ashtaroths, national, large regional gods, but more family gods. Let's look at this just a little bit before we get into the issues. This would be the gods. The distinct word is teraphim. So, whenever you read in the Ten Commandments, thou shalt have no other gods before me, that's Elohim. You shall have no Elohim before me. Okay? When you read about idols, do not make idols, that's Elil. Or you might see other references to gods as Elim. This word is teraphim. It's a very distinct god. And I'll just read from a few different resources here. One suggestion is that like Roman tradition, these small images guarded the threshold and the hearth. Akin to good luck charms or charm bracelets. Some girls have charm bracelets and they like to collect all the figures of Disney or whatever just as a collectible. But, others regard them as, oh, these are lucky charms. These bring good luck. All right. Now, here's some more information about it. They're not associated with temples or national cults for the major deities. One recent study has suggested they were figurines of ancestors, but others see them as more generally related to the family's patron deity. So there's a little discussion, like that beak face one on the left-hand side. Is that somebody's ancestor? It's like, my kid ever make a carving of me like that, I'll smack him. It looks awful. But that whole idea. It says in some archives from the middle second millennium B.C., which would be around 1500 B.C., legal documents allow us to see how the family gods, teraphim, figured in the inheritance. At Newsy, several texts indicate that the principal heir received the family gods. In texts from MR, one document suggests that the household gods were not to be given to a man outside the family. Rachel would have no right to this portion of the inheritance, nor would Jacob. Laban is logically distressed over this breach of inheritance practices, as well as concerned that the care of the ancestors will be jeopardized by the loss of the images. The family gods were not only the tie between the family unit and its prosperity, but also the very heart of the family. We therefore conclude that Rachel's interest in the teraphim has more to do with family and inheritance than with the issue of worshiping other gods. The spirits and the ancestors were not substitute deities, though some uses of them were certainly prohibited in the Torah as it eventually took shape. Okay, so, as we think about, this care, we've got these family relics, and especially if that's Aunt Bertha over there on the left or something. Laban would be concerned. These are our family relics. They're good luck charms. They bring us prosperity. But we don't want a non-family member taking them because something might happen to them. And what happened to these in chapter 35? Jacob buries them under the oak tree at Shechem. Okay, it's like, we're getting rid of all this stuff because we're going to worship God alone. Pure worship. So yeah, you know, Laban is right to be concerned. Is this full-blown idolatry as Baal worship and offering your children to Molech? I don't think, as I, what little I understand about this, I don't think it's full-blown idolatry. I would think of it, you know, maybe not quite as innocent, but somewhat akin to some family superstitions I grew up with. I think it was my grandma who said, oh, there's a penny, pick it up and keep it, it'll bring you good luck. All right. Anybody ever hear that, or is that just me? Okay, so some of you have. Okay, yeah. And so what happens? You're out there, and there's this penny, you know, in the dirt, and it's filthy, and you really don't want anything to do with it. But in the back of your mind, you're like, oh, you should pick that up and stick it in your pocket. It's good luck, you know. So you do. Okay. Or you see a falling star, and you wish upon it. Oh, there's a falling star. I can make a wish. And you know that there's somehow some kind of magic in that. Okay. Is that full-blown idolatry? It's not a purposeful statement against the sovereignty of God when I, as a 10-year-old boy, picked up that penny and stuck it in my pocket. But it's also not spiritually healthy to tie our expectations and wishes and belief and faith into anything or any force other than God Himself. And so, what are we doing with these gods? You know, I don't fully know. I don't fully understand why Rachel was interested. You know, and why Laban even had them. But my suspicion is this is not full-blown idolatry as we would think of. Okay? Now, so with that understanding, let's plow ahead. Okay? Laban follows Jacob in hot pursuit, but in the process he is warned of God to take care of how he approaches Jacob. We see that in verse number 22. Laban was told on the third day, he took his brethren with him, he pursued. And it says there in verse 24, God said, be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad. Now, Laban is hot. And he is upset. And look at verse 26. He lets Jacob know this in verse 26. He says, what have you done? You've stolen away unknown to me and carried away my daughters like captives. Why did you flee away and steal away from me and not tell me? And look at verse 29. It is in my power to do you harm. Okay, so I take it that means he's pretty hot. And this doing harm, I don't think he's talking about I'm going to bend you over and spank you. You know, I think it's a death threat or loss of limb kind of. You know, it seems to be the whole chapter has a lot of war language in it. You know, when you have these words like fleeing and pursuit and pitching your tent against someone, okay, and stuff like that. There's and taking by force, and you took, you know, I'm afraid that you would take my wives by force. And he accused him of taking them away as with a sword. I mean, there's just a lot of warfare kind of language. Okay, you know, Laban is hot. He's upset. Now let's take for just a moment. Why is he hot? And you know, obviously the whole circumstance, but this whole thing with Rachel and the stealing of the gods, that's what he ends with when he gives his complaints in verse number 30. You've surely gone because you greatly long for your father's house. Now there is almost an admission. I can see why you're going. You long for your father's house, but why did you steal my gods? Okay, you know, that just is like, why would you do this? On the way out the door, our family gods, why would you steal these? Are terrifying. Why would Rachel steal them? Let's grant that she's probably a believer at this point, that she prays to Yahweh and trusts Yahweh. And that, look at the teraphim again. You know, they're not expensive idols. These are clay. So it's not like these are gold things that she's going to melt down and get a lot of wealth out of. So, you know, why would she steal these? I want to propose, could this be a petty act of retribution to her father, who messed up her monogamous relationship with Jacob? And just on the way out the door, just one little tweak to the family as we leave. She had to know, he would know who took them, someone of Jacob's household. I mean, it's just that you leave all of a sudden, and all of a sudden the family gods are off of the mantle, so to say. She had to know that he would know. And I think that
this is just a slap in the face. That, you know what, my father can just sit in Haran and stew about this. We're going to be long gone. And it might be the very thing that caused him not to just sit, and caused him to pursue hotly. And would she have ever guessed that her husband would utter the words, "Whoever you find them with, kill him"? I think that as I imagine her sitting in the tent with her father looking and her husband's words, "Whoever you find them with, his life is in your hands," I have to think her life is full of regret at the moment. Her mind is full of regret that this was an extremely stupid thing to do. Extremely sinful and extremely ignorant. This petty act, or whatever act it was, it jeopardizes everything for her. And, I guess if there's an application as I think about that, if that is why she did it, and that's an if, but if that is why she did it, just to tweak her father on the way out the door, as I think about our own human relationships, there might come to the point where we need to part with others. You know, maybe it's a business relationship that's gone bad. Maybe there's just distant family that, you know, there just isn't. It just doesn't repair. It doesn't repair. There's no opportunity, and there's no command of God that we, you know, live close to this sister or to this grandfather or whatever it might be. You know, neighbors. You know, if you have neighbors that there just simply is no peace with this kind of person, and yet you've been tied in with them a little bit, but that is just wrong, and there needs to be this separation. Okay, I would say the application would be this: avoid pettiness. Don't seek to have the last word. Don't seek to make them regret your parting. Don't burn your bridges. If you're at that point in a relationship, then do what needs to be done in a peacefully mature way. Now, as we continue here, Laban unloads volumes of complaints at Jacob's actions, letting him know that it was in his power to harm him, but that God had intervened, and that is a key statement there. Verse number 30. I better read it all here. I lost where he says God intervened. Jacob said, "What have you done?" Laban said, "What have you done? You've stolen away." Verse 27, "Why did you flee me secretly?" Verse 29. "It is in the power of my power to do you harm, but the God of your father spoke to me last night saying, 'Be careful that you speak to Jacob neither good nor bad.'" So as we look at this rebuke and this statement that God has intervened, it's going to become a key point in the whole narrative, that God is protecting Jacob. And we have this protection, you know, living itself out through some deceit, okay? Rachel this time is a deceitful one. Rachel is sitting on a saddlebag or some kind of a pouch that has the gods in it. And as he searches her tent, she says, "Pardon me for not getting up, but the manner of women is upon me," her menstrual period. So it's like, why would that prevent him from searching? Well, in antiquities, you know, when you regard the female cycle, you just as well say to a man, "I have leprosy." Okay, you know, it's like that. There was a lot of superstition surrounding, you know, the menstrual cycle, and so as she says that, it's like he's not going to go near to her or anything she touches when she makes that statement. There might also be some imagery in what all Israel thought of false gods with her sitting with her menstrual cycle on top of these gods. But that's what some people suggest. I don't quite see that as much in the text, but that might be there, you know, just for your own future study. So now Laban comes up from this empty-handed, and Jacob's anger now is kindled, and he rebukes Laban in a way that we had not seen before. Verse number 36, Jacob was angry and rebuked Laban, and answered and said, "What is my trespass?" And he just lays it on the line. Now, keep in mind, as Jacob gets righteously indignant, okay, toward Laban, he has no clue that his party is as guilty as sin. They have the gods. They're in Rachel's tent, okay? But in God's sovereignty, Jacob is totally oblivious to this. And here is his oppressor of 20 years. And he just, as in a way that we've not seen it ever before in the narrative, Jacob just lays it out on the line, everything that's gone wrong. And Laban has nothing to answer. You've changed my wages 10 times. Laban doesn't argue. You've done this. You've done, you know, just, he lays it on the line. This to me is reminiscent of some things we've seen. Remember when Abraham and King Abimelech, it was in Genesis 21, were going to have a treaty, and Abraham said, well, wait a minute, Abimelech, I need to rebuke you because this well I dug, your servant have taken. And Abimelech's like, what? I had never knew about this today. You did not mention it to me. How could I know? And so, and then they have their covenant, and they're going to cut the animals for the covenant, and Abimelech's like, what are those 7 ewes over there? Well, you're going to take those from me, Abraham said, as a covenant that I own that well. See, so Abraham wisely, when the peace agreement came time to be signed, Abraham wisely signed the peace agreement, but he brought his grievances forward, and I think that's important. You know, when we're making peace, it needs to be a two-sided peace. It can't all just be one-sided. And then we have Isaac later on, who his peace agreement was with King Abimelech again, maybe a different King Abimelech that, you know, had took his father's name in Gerar. But that King Abimelech came to him asking for a covenant in Genesis 26. And he made peace with Abimelech. Even though that King Abimelech had said, get out, get away from us, we fear you. Even though that King Abimelech's servants had filled in his wells and had disputed his wells, Isaac secured the peace. And now we've seen this Jacob who's been a deceiver, who has not been commendable in much of his behavior, and he's securing peace. There's nothing conniving going on here on Jacob's part. I mean, this is a new Jacob. He is just straightforward, securing the peace that is rightfully his without seeking to take advantage of Laban. And we'll see in 3 weeks when I'm back with you, we're going to see it happen again with Esau. Jacob is just going to straightforward secure the peace. As you look at some of Jacob's complaints, when there was something stolen, I had to bear the loss. That was fairly common in ancient herding contracts, shepherding contracts. Jacob cites God's protection too. Look at verse 42. Verse 42. Unless the God of my father, the God of Abraham, the fear of Isaac, had been with me, surely now you would have sent me away empty-handed. God has seen my affliction and the labor of my hands, and rebuked you last night. And that does seem to be the turning point for Laban. When he was hotly pursuing him, I think he had all options on the table. And then God intervened, and it had to, he had to be peaceful in dealing with Jacob. Laban, verse letter D here, in denial about ownership of the flocks and family, yet helpless to manipulate the situation into his favor, offers a peace treaty with Jacob, which Jacob wisely secures. In verse 43 and following, Laban answered and said to Jacob, these daughters are my daughters, and these children are my children. This flock is my flock. All that you see is mine, but what can I do this day to these my daughters or to their children whom they have borne? Now therefore come, let us make a covenant, you and I. Let it be a witness between us. So, in the treaty now, Jacob will go on to express concern that he not take any wives. Look at verse 50. If you afflict my daughters, or if you take other wives besides my daughters, although no man is with us, see, God is witness between you and me. This is Laban's own sin coming back to haunt him a little bit. With his daughters in his household, if Jacob were to leave them, well, they're cared for. Now they're going to be over in the next country. They're going to be far away from home. And they have no dowry. They have nothing. He has spent it. So what happens to their status as wives if Jacob were to marry a third wife who truly had a dowry? Well, they would become concubines. They would lose rank. They would lose status. And that is just the situation in antiquities. And so Laban is very concerned. It's not that he's monogamous. We know better than that. He's the one who gave Leah away first in deceit, right? No, he's concerned about his sin and what it has done to his daughters. And so, and part of this treaty is you don't marry any true wives. You don't marry any additional women. He wants to protect the status of his daughters. Now, as I said before, there's this theme of maturity in Jacob's life and a theme of God's blessing. We've seen this over and over again. You remember Genesis 12:3? Those who bless you, I will bless, and those who dishonor you, I will curse. Okay, we saw that. That's the Abrahamic promise. We've seen that lived out. We're seeing that lived out in Jacob's life. He has been blessed. And quite frankly, Laban, who dishonored his word to Jacob, has been cursed. He has lost a great deal of wealth at God's hand. So we can say this about Jacob. He's blessed. His life is blessed. Here's the question I have for you this morning. Is his life easy? He's blessed. It's documented. He's got the Abrahamic promise. Is his life easy? Isaac's life. He was blessed. Clearly blessed of God, but they were filling in his wells, you know, threatening his very life. But, you know, with lack of water, his lives of his herds and his servants, he was blessed. Was his life easy? No. Abraham was blessed. Was his life easy? Absolutely not. Now, I don't know if it's just me, but there's just something in me that just says, okay, these men, according to biblical definitions from God, were blessed. And there's something in me that's just kind of glad it's not easy for them either. You know, as you look at the landscape of your life and you look at all the circumstances, and they are difficult circumstances. They're not easy. Does that mean you're not blessed? This is exactly the landscape of the life of someone who is blessed. Was he a sinner? Yes, Jacob was a sinner. Did he have some poetic justice for his sins? I mean, he deceived by dressing up in skins, and he was deceived by somebody dressing up in a veil. He was deceived by posing as a sibling. He was deceived by Leah posing as her sibling. And, you know, it just totally undid this beautiful monogamous relationship that he was going to have. And it just seems almost poetic the way he suffers at the hand of Laban. He suffers from the sin of, you know, deception coming from Laban. And I'm, you know, there's just something in me that as I read about the patriarchs, I'm glad to see this. Because when I look around at my life and some of your lives, it's not easy. The other thing I'm glad about is even in all this hardship, I can see God using sin and problems to accomplish some great things. Jacob has the largest family we've seen in any genealogical record in the Bible so far. Yes, there was polygamy and maidservants, but it seems that God used that to establish what will one day be the 12 tribes of Israel. You know, two sons coming from Joseph. We see the hand, the deception, the hard work he had to do with shepherding, and it seems that God used that eventually to build his wealth. We see the family problems arise, and I think these were more than our family problems. I think there was fear for life involved in this, and yet God uses that to move him back to the promised land. So as I look at the sin, and I look at the just ugly things that people suffer in the Scriptures, I see God using all of that to move. And that gives me hope that the things that we are suffering and the things that even that we have sinned and the consequences are poetic justice in our lives, that God can use all of that. So I, for one, am thankful. His life is blessed, but it's not easy. So as we conclude this morning, I would say God's hand of blessing has passed from Abraham to Isaac to Jacob. Even as Laban was working against Jacob, God is using circumstances to move Jacob. Jacob, I think we see a life that is maturing in God. I was a little surprised at some of the backlash that I had from some of you fellow Bible students. You know, when I first went through that narrative of Jacob deceiving Esau and his mother deceiving, you know, Isaac as well. And, you know, I think a lot of us kind of come to it, well, it's Jacob, it's Israel. How could he be that wicked? And no, all the text talks about how truly wicked he was. But what we are seeing here in this text, I didn't see any conniving. Did you today in chapter 31? Did you see one conniving work out of Jacob? He was totally unaware, the narrator says, totally unaware that Rachel had stolen these gods. There's no faking. He's the real deal throughout this narrative. He secures peace where peace is needed, even when it involves separating. And he was not involved in any pettiness towards Laban. So Jacob is maturing, and I think we're going to see that again in 3 weeks when we're together again. And then, like I say, I just take away from this that blessed lives are not easy lives. We dare not equate the two. That if you're blessed of God, if you're chosen of God, it's going to be easy and sinless. That God might have some difficult circumstances in your life and my life for a purpose. God might be preparing you through these trials. I pray that He is. Let's pray.